Good morning. So I'm realizing as I put this up here how long our title is. We tend to have a problem with that. As Anne was saying, my job title is Interpersonal Violence Prevention Coordinator on campus, and my job title is so long that people sometimes forget the word prevention in my job title and call me the Interpersonal Violence Coordinator. So I have to clarify that that's not what we do on campus. We try to actually prevent sexual assault, relationship violence, and stalking. And one way we do that is through bystander education programs, and we'll tell you about that. We don't have any disclosures here. A very brief background. I could stand here and show you statistics all day long, but I'll just be very brief here and say that we know that approximately 20-25% of college women experience IPV, which includes sexual assault, stalking, dating violence, and intimate partner violence. We don't have good numbers on campus necessarily for people in same-sex relationships, men or folks who are genderqueer, but I know some of the most recent stats say that in LGBT or lesbian, gay, and bisexual relationships, the numbers range anywhere from around 17-52% as far as people experiencing intimate partner violence. We see this as a public health issue for many reasons, but specifically some of the consequences of sexual assault, relationship violence, and stalking include physical and mental health consequences, chronic pain, migraines and headaches, GI disorders, which is a new field that people are really starting to better understand now as being related to these issues, STIs, obviously, and unwanted pregnancy for female survivors, disability, depression, suicidal thoughts, anxiety, and of course, post-traumatic stress disorder. So on campus, this is something that's becoming more and more of a bigger issue and a topic for prevention. And one of the most recent things that came out was the April 2011 Dear Colleague letter from the Office of Civil Rights and the Department of Education that pressed colleges to review their Title IX requirements and do more training and education and to have better policies and to educate students around these policies. And more recently, that was strengthened even more by the Campus Save Act, which was part of the national reauthorization of VAWA. And some points from the Campus Save Act are that they require campuses to have primary prevention and awareness programs for all incoming students and new employees. The key point here is that they have safe and positive options for bystander intervention. We'll talk about what that means in a second. That's sort of the leading trend. For them to have information on risk reduction to recognize warning signs of abusive behavior, and for colleges and universities to have ongoing prevention and awareness programs for students and faculty. I will say that colleges across the country are really, I think, scrambling to do this because I think that there's been a desire from pockets within all of these campuses, but not necessarily a larger scale movement, nor necessarily incredibly good research out there for the best way to do these things. So Lisak and Miller, David Lisak, and I think it's Andrew Miller, their research tells us the most, I think, about perpetration of sexual violence, in particular on college campuses. There seems to be a sort of ongoing myth on college campuses that men and women, and this is generally a heterosexual script, but not necessarily, but that men and women don't communicate about sex, and men accidentally push it too far, they're both drinking, and rape just happens, right? David Lisak and his colleagues' research shows that that's not really the case, and they give us some really good information about perpetration and what they call the undetected rapist on campus. And what their research said was, to sort of sum it up, they studied almost 2,000 college men. 6.4% of them had committed rape or attempted rape on campus. Of that sample, 2.3% had committed a single rape. So 44 out of the sample had committed rape one time. 4.1% of those men, so two-thirds of the 6.4 who had committed sexual assault, were responsible for 439 sexual assaults, right? So to sort of sum that up in bold there, the important thing to take away is that 90% of sexual assaults are committed by 4% of the population. So in other words, sexual assault is not something that necessarily happens by accident or by people who don't know what they're doing. 90% of sexual assaults are by serial perpetrators who have a particular MO and target victims and work with them. So what does that tell us? What do we do with that? So what it tells us is that we need to identify perpetrators and their modus operandi. So right, we need to know how perpetrators work and how they're targeting victims, including giving them alcohol, isolating them from their friends, right, taking them away from people. We have to see this as a community issue. We have to get more men involved. We have to re-examine our environment, right, from a public health approach, not just looking at individuals and the individual's psychopathology, but looking at the environments and the relationships that they're in, to identify where assaults are happening and who is enabling them, and empowering bystanders to intervene to prevent assaults. So what that means is, in the middle we have those, and the proportions aren't correct in that diagram, but in the middle we have that small degree of sex offenders, and we know they don't operate in a vacuum, right? So to give an example, perhaps a stereotypical one, but we know there are higher correlations of fraternity men who assault. If we're going to use a fraternity as an example, if there's a sex offender in a fraternity, a facilitator would be his fraternity brother who's giving his target alcohol, right, or encouraging his target to go up with them to his room, right? Bystanders might be the people at the party who maybe see that he's hitting on a drunk person or a drunk woman, right, or see that he is taking this person upstairs even though they seem to be too drunk to, you know, consent, right? And so what we know is that in the great majority of cases, not all cases, but we do know that bystanders can see warning signs and see dangerous situations. And the point of bystander intervention theory and training programs across campus are to train students to recognize warning signs, risky situations, dangerous situations, not only for sexual assault but also for stalking and relationship violence. It's not honestly true primary prevention, right? Because we're not really getting to the sex offenders and the facilitators, but the way I see it is that we're not going to be able to do really true primary prevention on a college campus, because for me to go up to a room of men and treat them all as potential perpetrators, right, especially when there's only about 6% of that group who might be a perpetrator, it's going to alienate all the potential partners that we have across campus to be allies and to help us out. Not to mention, I'm pretty sure I'm not going to convince a serial offender in my 1 hour or 4 hour or 4 day presentation or talk or workshop not to assault, much less figure out how to find them in the first place. So the point of bystander programs is to empower bystanders, help them know the dynamics of sexual assault, relationship violence, and stalking, feel committed to take action, and then not only have them sort of have knowledge and commitment sort of the belief, but also give them the skills, right? So to teach them skills for intervening to do something. So these programs, the research is around 20 years old, but they're really becoming, have in the last 5 years or more, been really implemented more across college campuses with programs like Bringing the Bystander. Has anybody heard of Green Dot on their campus, right? These are all programs for training students. Some of them are sort of nationally based. On our campus, we created one that was in collaboration with students, based on research and best practices, based on some other curricula, but really tailored for our university. But the strength of these programs are community-based. It's not just looking at the individual level. They are strengths-based. They're approaching students as being helpers and allies and sort of using their own skills. We don't tell them exactly what to do necessarily. We give them a range of options for acting and help them figure out what works best for them. And we treat them as the experts, right? So here's the situation. What would you do? And how can you teach your fellow students some good options for action? There's promising but limiting research. So there is increased self-reported knowledge of and self-efficacy in preventing violence. There are improvements in participants' sexual assault knowledge, sexual assault attitudes, and bystander behaviors. So there are some programs that are showing improved behaviors, and that's something that we're trying to get to as well. Rigorous evaluations of these programs are scarce, largely due to small sample sizes. So we're going to talk about our program in a second. To describe our training programs, we have two programs at UNC Chapel Hill. I'll start from the bottom, is Haven. It's a program that's existed for almost 10 years. Both of these are four-hour programs. Haven teaches students, as well as faculty and staff, definitions and dynamics, sort of basic 101 around these issues. And teaches them then how to respond to survivors and refer to appropriate resources. So when I came on campus 5 years ago, this is pretty much all we had. It's a great program. It helps survivors get help they need, but it's not really doing much to intervene or prevent. So we started One Act, which is the program I was describing earlier, our bystander education program, which seeks to counteract the bystander effect, whereby responsibility is diffused, right? The bystander effect is the more people around, the fewer people who are going to take that step up and take responsibility. So we've worked to change that. And One Act teaches knowledge and skills to change beliefs and inspire action to prevent interpersonal violence. So I'm going to bring up my colleague, Kay Alegria Flores, to talk about the evaluation that we did of these programs.
Hello. Hi. So I'm a second-year doctoral student at UNC Chapel Hill, and early this year I started working with the UNC Student Wellness as a graduate assistant, and that's how I became involved with the evaluation of One Act. So before I tell you more about the evaluations, because there were two of them, it is important that I explain why we actually used data from the Haven program in the process of the evaluations. So as Bob already explained, One Act and Haven both address interpersonal violence. However, One Act focuses on prevention through bystander training, whereas Haven focuses on response by training students to become allies to survivors. So since students self-select to participate in both trainings, so neither group is randomly selected, they actually are very similar students. They have usually the same demographics, same characteristics, same motivation for coming to these trainings. So that makes Haven actually a very ideal comparison group for One Act. And that's what we did. So now there are two evaluations that we did. The first one, the preliminary evaluation results, is based on the data from the first 2 years of One Act, the One Act implementation. And the second one that I will talk after this is based on the last 2 years of One Act implementation. Okay, so as we see for this preliminary evaluation results, we had the group of One Act students and the group of Haven students. They were both undergraduate students only. We used t-tests comparing the two groups with pre-tests right before the training and the post-test, which was 1 week after training and 2 weeks after training.
2 months.
2 months after training, yes, thank you. And as the results, we actually saw that the student score for the four composite scales that we use as the outcome measures, three of them increased. So the attitudes towards date rape, self-efficacy, and willingness to help other people increased. And One Act participants also reported greater improvement in bystander behaviors. Some of the limitations we had with that first preliminary evaluation, though. First, we have participant overlap. So many of the students, as I said, they have similar motivations to participating in this training, so they actually came to both trainings, and we didn't really separate the students from the sample. We also had reliability issues with the scales, so not all of our scales had higher than 0.7 convex score. And we also didn't test for any correlations or control for other variables. And during the first year of the implementation of the program, it was actually still evolving. So there were a lot of changes that we made based on the feedback that we received from students. So we did a second evaluation based on the last 2 years of program implementation. And this time we used a linear mixed model analysis approach. So we were able to look at differences within our participants and also between the groups. And we had, again, the intervention group was One Act, and then the comparison group was Haven. We did two steps in the evaluation process. We only looked at One Act first and saw the differences pre- and post-test. And then we looked at One Act versus Haven and saw differences there, if the programs had a different impact over time. And our dependent variable, again, was the composite scale scores, which I will talk about in a second. And we have fixed effects, which are the type of training attended, type of survey. T1 is the pretest, T2 is the 1 week post-test, and T3 is a 2 month post-test. Then we had an interaction term. And then for the random subject effects, we had the control variables. So the participants, again, it was from the past 2 years. We have 594 students who participated in One Act. 336 who participated in HIVET, and this is after we cleaned the data. So we actually had a lot more students who were trained, but we had to, unfortunately, had some missing data problems and also identification matching problems. So we had to clean it, and this is the final numbers that we used. If a student participated in both trainings, we only used data from the first training that was attended. And for the sampling, we had an opt-in process, so students, again, chose to be part of the trainings. For one-off trainings, we had students participate as individuals. They just sign up as an individual, and sometimes we actually had students sign up as groups, so student organizations or people who live in the same dormitory would go and train groups together, as opposed to Haven, which was purely individual opt-in process. And for response rates, we did see some dropping of people over time. We had 60% and 30% for one act, for the first post-test and the second post-test, and then 28% for Haven's post-tests. And we did give them some incentives. The measures that we used were these four scales: the College Date Rape Attitudes and Behavior Scale, the Bystander Efficacy Scale, Willingness to Help Scale, and the Bystander Behavior Scale. And these were the results. So you can kind of see here that over time we see improvement pretty much in all of them. The solid line is one act, the dotted line is Haven. And in the first College Date Rape Attitudes and Behavior Scale, which is one that we expected both to increase equally since we do train them equally on that, they actually did not have any significant differences over time between the two groups in how they changed. For the Bystander Efficacy Scale and the Willingness to Act Scale, one act was significantly higher, better improvement for student scores. And for the Bystander Behavior Scale, we saw something strange happen. So one act did increase, but Haven decreased. Unfortunately, we had a lot of missing data for that particular scale because students were asked to report on the past 2 months if they had been exposed to a situation where they actually had an opportunity to act. If they were not exposed to that situation, they just responded non-applicable. So unfortunately, we're going to hopefully get some more data in future years and be able to interpret that better. So those results were shown, but they were not statistically significant for the Bystander Behavior Scale. And so some conclusions. One-act training has improved the participants' attitudes, self-efficacy, and willingness to help others. And in comparing it to Haven, it actually did a better job for all those three scales, well, for the scales that were expected to be different. And for the Bystander Behavior Scale, again, we're going to have to wait for another few years to see how it changes. And we also know now that the bystander component of the training is really what makes a difference, since the Haven is a response training and it doesn't really have the bystander component. So these are some of our limitations, and for future research, we're definitely going to be working on validating the scales, which we haven't done, and maybe, hopefully, having a control group in the future. Okay, those are some of our references and funding, and that's it. And I guess questions will be at the end.
Yeah.